Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're on Team Human, conscious intervention in the machine, an opportunity to pause the engines of capitalism, break the feedback loop between our processors and ourselves, and to restore our relationship with nature before nature chooses a better advocate than us. It's not too late to change course. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, author and technology historian, author of Analogia, The Entangled Destinies of Nature, Human Beings and Machines, George Dyson.
The biggest problem is sort of anthropocentrism, where we think we are the center of the universe, that it revolves around us. It doesn't. You know, look at the big picture.
George will be helping us take a less human-centered perspective on our place in the cosmos, for our own and everything's best interests. It's time to intervene on behalf of life itself. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. We're happy to announce a special virtual Team Human Live event exclusively for our Team Human Patreon supporters. Join me in a conversation with director, choreographer, world-renowned dancer, and Chinese philosopher Yin Mei Critchell, live on December 1st. This special virtual event will benefit Queens College's Kupferberg Center for the Arts. To register, you can find the Eventbrite link pinned to our Patreon supporters page. You too can become a contributing supporter of Team Human for as little as $2 per month. Go to teamhuman.fm to join our Discord community, gain access to special bonus episodes like an election bonus monologue that went up last week, and claim special digital rewards. Join patrons like Tara Penny, Zola Jesus, Ethan Atkins, Octave, and Joshua Volis. Thanks for supporting Team Human. I know everyone is expecting me to say something about the elections, but the only important thing I have to share is this. No revenge. No I told you so's. No gloating. Truth and reconciliation, what Mandela did after apartheid, is the only valid path forward. I saw a notice of a website called the Trump Accountability Project. It's basically an effort to archive all the pro-Trump posts on Twitter and elsewhere to, quote, remember what they did, unquote. Now, the project says it's limiting itself to documenting people who worked for the administration or spent a lot of money to further the agenda of separating kids from their parents or promoting COVID conspiracy myths. But we have to be really careful about ostracizing people who need to be welcomed back into a more United States of America. A lot of folks I'm speaking with, particularly a lot of the QAnon followers, they're really a bit like cult victims. They fell too far into the rabbit hole. And the first few weird things, maybe, you know, they weren't so weird, but they slowly bring you further and further from normal until you're being asked to believe progressively strange stuff. And then your brain can end up connecting any two ideas and produce a kind of a cause and effect relationship between them. So, you know, 5G towers caused COVID, or there were no Republican vote counters at the bipartisan vote counting tables in Pennsylvania, right? You could just end up believing weird stuff. And it's really painful to find out that what you've believed in is untrue, just as it's painful for progressives to find out that neoliberal politicians have been cynically leveraging race theory and intersectionalism in order to control us. We're not going to deprogram anyone if we're taking names and putting stuff down on people's permanent records. No. The only way we as a civilization can change is if we accept that each and every one of us is changing all the time. The digital media environment makes it awfully hard, but we have to forgive and forget. This was actually a sad week for Team Human. We lost one of our great humans and one of my very best lifelong friends, Mark Filippi. You may remember Mark from the episode we recorded live with him at the Alchemist's Kitchen in New York City back in June 2018. Mark died of what the doctors call lymphoma, but he refused to accept that diagnosis, or really the whole medical metaphor. He was rather insufferable about this, to tell you the absolute truth. His approach to the life-threatening condition reminded me of my mother's lost battle with leukemia. She just wouldn't do any of the medical protocols. She considered it all poison, refused traditional medicine, and she died a lot sooner than she had to. But she believed that the various forms of quantum healing in which she was engaged could reverse the course of her disease. You know, it's hard to know whether to support a person who makes these sorts of choices, or to try to change their mind, or maybe to do both at the same time. And with Mark, it was particularly hard. He was a healer in his own right, not just a well-educated and talented chiropractor, but for those of us who experienced him, he's a guy working on another plane, using from Bucky Fuller to Alfred Korzybski to Irving Dardick and David Bohm. Mark's work and practice, it combined physiology with biological clocks and somatic personality types with organ consciousness. So when he says he doesn't want to do radiation or chemo, it's because he feels those modalities will compromise his connection to the ethereal realm. It's as if they would compromise or occlude the natural expression of his soul, disconnecting him from his very life force, from his kundalini, from his mojo. And yes, a whole lot of what he objected to may sound like conspiracy theory. You know, he was one of the main guys who treats vaccination casualties. And while those may actually be truly far and few between, he spent all day with them trying to help them learn to walk or speak or digest or breathe on their own again. And he revived a whole lot of folks who'd been totally dismissed by traditional medicine as candidates for permanent paralysis and institutionalization. So I learned to respect his decision, as well as the metaphors he used to describe what his body was going through. And it was hard, because I was also mad at him for not doing what I believed could, at the very least, give him some more years of life, or give me some more years of him. But Mark is responsible for my own work about cycles and time. In my book, Present Shock, there's this big section on how different moon phases are associated with different neurotransmitters. The idea is that when there's a new moon, you tend to be dominated by acetylcholine, which is great for like meeting people and having new ideas. But then as you move toward the full moon, you tend to secrete more serotonin into the bloodstream, which is great for getting work done. You know, really, for me, that was my writing week. Then on the week when the moon is starting to wane, you're dominated by dopamine, which is like the party drug. That's when you get together with people or go skiing. You know, it's downhill rush. It's you go to Six Flags, you know. And then finally, norepinephrine in that last week, that's kind of cold and steely and clinical and analytical. It's the fight or flight hormone, but it's great for for me, organizing chapters or planning a schedule. It's very structural. And then as I synchronized my work, social, rest, life schedule to those four different really somatic lunar states, I started to feel really much more, not just efficient, but stronger and coherent. I mean, take a listen. This is from the conversation I had with Mark on Team Human for an idea of how he thinks about this stuff.
When you're in that mode, it kind of lends itself, again, norepinephrine is the postsynaptic neurotransmitter. So acetylcholine is presynaptic. So I'm planning in acetylcholine, and then I act. And when I act, I'm going to get feedback. The environment's going to say something back to me. And if we're more coherent than the environment, guess what? We have what's called influence. Hmm. And if we don't, then we have to adapt. So we take our lumps. This is what evolution is. And it's the sum total of that process of I win, I lose, I win, I lose, until basically I've achieved some level of on the food chain of, okay, I can handle this set of conditions for this period of time at this intensity. And when you get pushed out of your comfort zone, like I think most of us have been in the last year or two, you have to tear up the map again. And that's why the squirrel's right. Moon doesn't care. So if you orient your behaviors, especially if you're in a crisis, especially if you're going through a lot of change and turmoil in your life, especially if you had a loss or something hit you sideways that you didn't expect, it's like the most, probably the far away, the most difficult thing to do, again, we're in our heads, is to get here, the heart, the center, 60 times stronger than the brain, tune into that, because this sucker is tuned into the lunar cycles because of the way the energy works. This thing gets it faster than the brain. The brain is basically kind of like a storage facility for good memories and traumas and things that threaten us. The heart has to act because it has two functions, organ and muscle, and has a feel around it. So everyone's sitting around like we're in traffic court here. You're in these big toruses that are spinning around you 25 feet around your body, all right? And every layer of that is the same neurotransmitters played out spatially to see, do I know that guy who's, you know, 10 feet away? Like if you're on the airport, you go, is that my friend? No. Is that my friend? Your brain is doing exactly what the moon is doing to you, only now you're doing it the other direction, to detect safety. That's the first checkpoint. Is this person safe? Do I know this person? Do I like this person? Do I want to talk to this person? Do I really want to? Can I leave now? It's like you go through that constant oscillation of connection, disconnection. All those things are basically kind of grayscale. We've convinced ourselves it's black or white. That's why we're red state, blue state. We're all extreme because that has been programmed into our neurology every day.
I mean, as you listen, you can tell. I mean, a lot of it is either from, you know, Rudolf Steiner or Willem Reich, things that they knew about, and certainly the stuff that indigenous people are trying to remind us of. But then Mark built on all this and applied it to everything from social calendars and healing schedules and diet, you know, to the New York Mets and Giants with whom he was obsessed. You know, for the four phases that he's talking about, they correspond to four seasons, four directions, even the four personality types Mark identified, the Philos and Ontos and Ecos and Exos. He's got a website about all this stuff if you're interested in learning more. It's at somaspace.org, and you can go there and do a deep dive. I think in honor of Mark's life and work, the team at Team Human's going to try to reorganize all this stuff into a more accessible archive. There's hundreds of files and recordings, even whole books that deserve to be unearthed. It's hard to lose people. Genesis Peorage in February and now Mark Filippi. I feel blessed to have known them and to have been present to honor their passage. And I guess for me, that's the takeaway. You know, cherish the people you have and do whatever you can to rise to the occasion for their journey to whatever's next. It may be the most team human thing we get to experience here. It's my great pleasure pleasure to actually start the show. Playing for Team Human this week, the author of Turing's Cathedral about the origins of the digital universe, Darwin Among the Machines about the evolution of global intelligence, and the brand new Analogia, the emergence of technology beyond programmable control, George Dyson. I've been following your work pretty closely since, Darwin Among the Machines. And in that intro that you wrote, you said, and I'm wondering, I guess, how much this idea still informs your work. I mean, you said it kind of, I guess, as a joke, where you said basically that there's kind of three players in the game. There's humans, there's nature, and now there's machines. And that, well, that you said you prefer nature, and you suspect that nature prefers the machines. And this book that you've just written seems to argue that nature may indeed prefer the machines, that the machines and nature might kind of, I don't know, it feels a little scary, but kind of team up against us.
Yeah, it's not scary. I mean, I said nature is on the side of the machines. And yes, that still completely informs me. I mean, I think it's very, the biggest problem is sort of anthropocentrism, where we think we are the center of the universe, that it revolves around us. It doesn't. You know, look at the big picture. I mean, the, you know, machines are proceeding much faster than we are. I mean, that's what we all, of course, accept and know. But, you know, I mean, my take is that that's not necessarily a terrible thing, that nature finds its way, the life finds its way thing. And so if you were nature right now, sort of placing your bets, you'd bet on the machines. I mean, the things that we thought were most deeply lifelike are turning out to be little, very machine-like, in the sense that every oxygen molecule is exactly the same as the next one. It's very mechanical, and that's what gives rise to life. And then life itself is, or machines in the larger sense, the internet and the thing are looking, behaving more and more like life, where they're so complex we can't explain everything.
There's something reassuring in seeing that, oh, well, nature will always express itself again. You know, that you know, you talk about how first we had cold-blooded animals, then we had warm-blooded animals, but we started with warm-blooded tubes and then got cold-blooded digital, that these things will always, one will lead to the other, but then back to the first one again, that it's very cyclical, which is kind of reassuring on a certain level.
Yes. Just like all these chaotic periods in history lead to the sort of phase changes. Of course, we're seeing that right now.
Right. And so you're not afraid. I mean, you're not afraid for your kids and this, as we undergo this phase change. You don't think this is like an apocalyptic end of human life phase change?
No, certainly not. No, I mean, it's apocalyptic for certain institutions and trades. I mean, just think about the poor people who, you know, whose livelihood was printing T-shirts for conferences or something like that. I mean, it's devastating. That's the serious part. But for sort of life as a whole or humanity as a whole, no. But you have to put that in context. Of course, I've done all, you know, I got really scared very early in my life doing crazy things. And sort of once you've had that fear, you know, it puts everything in perspective.
And what kind of crazy things?
I mean, the things I used to do, like, you know, go out in the ocean in a little kayak I made myself in water that would kill you in 2 minutes and without a life jacket. I mean, you think you're immune. But at a certain point, you do get afraid, and then everything else looks mild in comparison.
Right. It's sort of like the way they try to cure people of autoimmune diseases now by, like, giving them a real infection. Right.
Right, yeah.
You want to be scared of something? Try this. You know? It's like, It changes your sensitivity to mortal threat. I guess the thing that's under threat now in a good way is this kind of more colonial energy, you know, this, you know, whether you call it tech broism or white Western European patriarchal colonization, that a lot of what you're looking at seems to be sort of how the colonizers end up colonized by the environments they go to and the indigenous people that they try to conquer. They end up almost overtaken by them in another way.
You hit the nail on the head there. I mean, that's why this current story opens in the Aleutians with the Russians arriving, who do the opposite of the normal European model was to go in and eliminate the indigenous technology and replace it with European technology. When the Russians came to America, the reverse happened. They adopted the indigenous technology, which is a very interesting model and very successful, sort of a hybrid model, which is, I believe, what we have to do. I mean, nature does that very much. I mean, the whole genetic system we all operate under was probably originally, you know, some sort of terrible infection.
But the Russians, when they were coming, which they weren't even Russians, I guess they were Russians they weren't coming to colonize and take over the same way, say, British East India Trading Company was.
They wanted to. They just didn't get support. The supplies they were promised from home never showed up, so they sort of had to improvise.
And they start making canoes out of skins and stuff instead of steam engines or whatever.
Yes, yeah, they just did whatever they could. Still why the Russians did so well in space for so long, I mean, because they had that sense of fix everything and get it working. Of course, to get to America, they had to travel by land, you know, with no roads, more than 5,000 miles across all of Siberia, just to get to the coast where they then could build boats.
Right. It was basically like us going to the moon in order to build rocket ships to go to Mars.
Right.
They were out already. I guess the parallel that you're trying to draw then is, as we build more and more complex technologies, eventually the digital environment ends up determining almost more about the technologies than we are, that they take on something like a life of their own. They become, as in your subtitle, you know, the emergence of technology beyond programmable control, that there's this moment where the algorithm or the AI or the program just continues on without us.
Yes, I mean, that sort of happened already. But the important sort of technical point is that we've been completely brainwashed. I spent a huge part of my life studying the origins of the digital universe, and that was not that long ago, 70 years ago. You had these oddballs who decided to build digital computers and claimed in a strictly mathematical sense that they could do anything, and nobody believed it. I mean, it was very difficult to convince people that these digital computers could actually do all these things. But of course they did, and it worked, and here we are, and now it's gone completely full circle. It's this sort of circular revolution you talked about, where now it's the opposite. You know, it's the heretical thing now to say, well, digital computers cannot do everything. There's a completely different form of computation, analog computation, that doesn't work that way at all. And because digital computers were so successful and they were programmed by programmers, we like to believe that the programmers are in control, and they are. They're in control of digital computing. But in analog computing, there's no program. There's no algorithm. I mean, if you take apart a human brain or the nervous system of a fly or a mouse or anything, you will not ever find any algorithm. They're just not there. It's a completely different form of computation. Nature uses analog computing for real-time control in nervous systems and uses digital computing for error correction in genetics. But they're two different things. And so now I felt it's time to sort of tip the scales back the other way and remind people that there are forms of computation that are completely beyond programmable control. And that's what we're doing now. If you look at the internet on a larger scale, all these companies that are being hauled before Congress, you know, to be broken up, their strength is not, I mean, they're digital companies, of course, but their strength is analog computing. That's what they're doing. They're computing with pulse frequency distributions and things like that have no algorithm at all. And that's why they're so successful. It's also why you can't break them up. I mean, if you break Amazon in half, you get two Amazons. It's foolish to think, you know, we're going to solve this problem by breaking them up.
I mean, it's like a Sorcerer's Apprentice thing. You've got the broom, and they're each going to grow.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard for people to imagine what analog computing really is, or what it looks like. I mean, it's not computers with tubes.
No, you can build digital computers out of bricks,
marble.
And you can build analog computers out of silicon. Sort of the important distinction is there is no algorithmic code. There is no logical sequential program. It's effectively, you know, digital computers, which we now accept because they're so fast, they only do one thing at a time. They just take one step and the next step, which, again, to Alan Turing was a very abstract thing. You just had to live with it. It might take half the age of the universe to do your computation, but it could be done. Then we got these insanely fast machines. I mean, I remember when Steve Jobs had his next computer and it was 25 megahertz. Now, of course, they're gigahertz. They just got faster and faster to a certain point, but they still are just doing one logical step at a time, whereas analog computers do everything at once. The brain of a fly or something doesn't go through a whole bunch of steps. It just, here I am, there's the wall, there's the sun, there's the, just integrates all that into its behavior. The complexity is in the architecture of the network, not any sort of sequence of code. It's a very different way of solving a real-world problem. There's no reason we can't do that with technology. We just sort of have been so successful with this digital stuff for so long, we've kind of gone into a loop.
And it's just, it's funny. I mean, people hear analog computing and they'll think, oh, well, it's like you're talking about, it's not the medium in which the computing takes place, or even that it's somehow illogical. It's not like, oh, it's this random computing. I mean, in nature, the equivalent might be the digital computing we do is our DNA, which has error correction and all that. The analog computing we do is like our nervous system.
Yes. Yeah. Just the way things work in the real world, the way many of these systems work. I mean, if you Google traffic or something like that, there isn't some central enormous IBM computer somewhere, looking at where you are and where you want to go and running a program that is, it's just that every car reports where it is and every car knows where it is. And the traffic itself is the map, the map is the territory,
right?
Which is very much a signature of living biological systems, that there is no model. There's no way to model a system that is not more complicated than the system itself. So
you let the system be its own model.
Yeah, the system becomes its own model. And that's very, very effective. My father used to have he came home one, he always would come home and say something he'd learned. And this was way, way back. He learned about the bus system in Cuernavaca, Mexico, which was the most effectively operating city bus system in the world. And in Cuernavaca, they hired these old guys who worked just basically for cigarettes. And so these old retired guys would just hang out at a bus stop and they would tell the bus driver how long it was since the last bus showed up. And the driver would then either kind of speed up or slow down. It was way, way, way pre-internet or anything like that. So the bus drivers had knowledge of just, they were given the knowledge to sort of space themselves out. So with absolutely no schedule, it optimized the bus system. The bus system started behaving like a, in physics, you'd say it was a one-dimensional gas where the molecules spaced themselves out. So with no central model of the bus system, you get it running really well, better than you can with anybody saying, oh, we're going to have a bus schedule and you guys are going to follow the schedule.
Right. The way a traffic circle might work so much better than the most advanced traffic light system where you've recorded and predicted and opened and closed gates. It's like, no, just let people go in the circle, go to the right, go counterclockwise, give right of way, and it's all going to be fine. It's sort of a good analog. And again, there's no symbol system, which is maybe part of what, another way to distinguish between this digital and analog. In digital, we have a symbol system which is abstracted from the reality in order to do the calculation, and then we apply it back to the real world. Right. Whereas these analog systems are the very things that they're computing about.
Yeah, like a vinyl record, it's a waveform.
Right.
Take a microscope, you'll see there's apparently human beings who can look at a record and hear the music. I mean, it's sort of on the spectrum of human abilities.
God bless them. But there's almost no one who can look at a digital. I mean, who knows? We'll find out. But they're using a different muscle to translate it anyway, if they're looking at the numbers. You don't show favoritism to digital versus analog reality. Although, if I look at your life history, I would think you're an analog person. You're like radio tubes, you're making canoes and living in a treehouse and making fires and learning waves, how to surf waves in the ocean. You seem like an analog guy, but I guess the reason why you're not threatened by all this digital discrete stuff is because the analog's going to grow through the spaces.
Yes. And of course, you know, my mother was a mathematical logician, so I sort of grew up in the world of what, you know, technically are called formal systems. But one of the things we know about formal systems, which is from Kurt Gödel, is that they cannot be complete. They can either be consistent or complete, but not both. So there's a limit to these, you know, to the extent of these formal systems. And both are going to survive. I mean, when I talk about an analog revolution, we're not going to get rid of the microprocessors. They're going to be there as they always have been. There's just a layer on top, the same way that nature has a genetic layer that is technically digital, but the control layer that is technically analog.
You find examples of what we could call digital record keeping in nature as well. You know, something as simple as the rings in a tree are a digital, pretty clear, discrete representation of each season.
Yes.
But I guess they came about in an analog way.
Yeah, it works both ways.
So they're all part of the same little world that we're living in.
Yeah, it's a symbiosis. But I believe we've shifted the needle a little too far to thinking that everything is digital and ignoring if you go to a computer science department, you'll have a hard time finding a course in analog computing. I mean, you'll find all sorts of coding languages and everything else, but very little, you know, we're sort of ignoring the analog side, which I personally think is a mistake. And the people who are working on it are going to be like the guys in the 60s playing with 4-bit microprocessors who took over the world. I mean, there are a few, the same kind of sort of small backroom garage operations doing really profound new forms of analog computing we're going to look back and say, well, that was the big thing, and we just sort of didn't recognize it.
And it's interesting because everyone in the computer industry will say, oh, if it's analog, it won't scale. You know, we want digital software based. They've got this perception that it's somehow, you know, more efficient because it's just...
Well, they're programmers. That's the problem. I mean, this will get angry comments. I mean, because it's sort of the religion of programming. Oh, you can't do that. Or don't you realize we do that with software already? Of course we do it with software. It's again, we knew from the beginning we could do it with software, but you can often do it much better in hardware.
I guess the other thing that kept occurring to me as I read this latest book was how quickly we seem to want to weaponize the technologies we come up with. So, you know, you're talking about the first example of digital communication being those mirror light towers that were being used to round up Native Americans, you know, that to send signals back and forth to each other. Or you say, we planted a flag on the moon using von Braun's rockets, then ran aground in Vietnam. 60 years after Sputnik, the flagship product of General Atomic is not Orion, the manned interplanetary spaceship. It is Predator, an unmanned drone.
Right, which they promised was only for non-offensive reconnaissance, not that it would never be a weaponized platform. But, of course, here we are.
But here we are. You know, and now, so whatever it is driving it, whether it's, you know, war driving cryptography, which led to computers, or the virtual sort of advertising arms race, you know, leading to the development of algorithmic prediction models and tracking, you know, we end up developing artificial intelligences that do deep learning and then get to a place where they no longer reveal how they're working. And that is both a good thing and a scary thing.
Yes.
I mean, you see it as the happy turn of the cycle.
No, I'm not saying it's happy, but it's something we need to recognize and not believe that we're going to fix it. I mean, this is the most terrifying thing to me ever is this movement that says, oh, all we need to do is appoint an ethics board to make sure that we have good AI. That terrifies me. Like, I'm way more afraid of good AI than of bad AI. Doesn't really scare me. The classic bad AI that tries to take over, and you know, because the guys here in Eastern Washington will take care of that real quick. But this idea that we can have some sort of course, it will be corporate ethics board that decides what AI is good and what's bad is that scary. That's
well, if Mark Zuckerberg or Sergey or Kurzweil called you up and said, "Just read your book. We're starting an AI committee you know, AI ethics committee here at Google to make sure we don't machine learn anything we really shouldn't. Will you join us? I mean, would you? It'd be fun.
I don't know. I mean, I sort of take the view my father had. I mean, he would always join those committees because he felt it was better to have somebody there.
than not. Right.
So there's that argument. But I think it's just absolutely foolish. It's not going to work.
But the thing we lay into the AI, I mean, now, if we're basically telling our AIs, extract as much data and money from people as you can for the rest of your life, go. That's going to, chances are, when that AI gets out of control, it might be doing worse things than an AI that we tell, help people recognize the humanity in everyone else and be nice to each other by any means necessary.
Right, but there's this sort of fundamental insane fallacy that, you know, which comes from the programmers who are used to programming the machine and it executes the program and it does what it's told. But by definition, AI, real AI, will not do what it's told. I mean, why do we think we're going to tell it what to do and it's going to do it? It's just by definition, it's not intelligent. If it's doing, you know, it's like your child. You finally realize your child is intelligent when it stops doing what it's told. You're like, oh, that's actually a different person who doesn't do what I tell him or her.
Yeah, but you hope that you've rewarded and punished them enough in their formative years that, you know, you've at least pushed them off in a good direction.
Yeah, you hope so, but you have no... You have no assurance and sort of believe we're going to always have this well-behaved AI. It doesn't interest me. I'm interested in wild AI that doesn't listen to instructions.
But aren't you interested in wild AI that doesn't necessarily listen to its instructions but is still benevolent?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, again, but it's so foolish to think that it is going to operate, you know, on the instructions we give it. It may be better. Maybe, you know, Jack Good, who was Turing's sort of closest companion during the code breaking. He wrote a paper on ethical machines, which is very, very, again, very prophetic early. You know, and his argument was, well, machines will probably do a better job than we do. We're really not very good at being ethical, so we shouldn't assume that machines are going to be unethical. They may be more ethical than we are. The thing is, this is no longer sort of academic. This is something we're living in. Even now, like right with this election, we're in this profound disconnect where we have these systems in place that, of course, you study way more than me. I mean, these are 21st century systems that are able to predict and manipulate how people will vote with very high accuracy. But the system for counting how they voted, it was bad already. I mean, it was sort of 20th century. It was bad 20th century technology for counting votes. I mean, we saw that with the Florida fiascos. So we just can't count better than 1 or 2% error. And now we're with this, you know, post office kind of stuff, we're moving it back into the 19th century. I mean, so there's this huge disconnect between the accuracy of the predictions and the accuracy of being actually able to count how people voted. So sort of by definition, it's a disaster.
It is. I mean, so in some ways, the predictive algorithms know better.
Yes, than the counting.
Our actual system.
Than the counting algorithm, which is insane. I mean, you can count, you know, the companies you like to complain about, that they're still good at counting. I mean,
yeah.
Google counts every click. I mean, every click is counted. Yet now we're saying we can't count how people are voting? Why not? I mean, we certainly could count how people are voting.
I would think. Although, interestingly enough, there's a Talmudic prohibition on counting people. You know, the census was illegal for ancient Israelites.
they knew what was coming.
I think they did. On a certain level, they did. And they realized it had to be, you know, more of a heart thing. Like, you get the gist of it. Like, even if you're doing a minyan, when you're supposed to pray, you're supposed to be at least 10 guys there, and now 10 men or women. But you're not allowed to count the people in the room. So how do you know if 10 are there? You know, they had these long diatribes on it. And the rabbi said, you can feel when the minion is there, which is sort of back to what you're saying, that it's something about nature, about an inner knowing ends up being required of humans when counting is no longer enough. It's interesting. You talked a lot about, and I always talk about noise and my love of noise, and how James Brown is not about the signal. What computers would call noise is where his soul lives, in the pieces that are not on the note. And then you say that digital computers are hardened against noise. And when you said that, again, I thought about Torah. And there's this great section where it says, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. You know, and I always thought about it that, oh, well, Pharaoh kind of gets so bad, he loses his free will, and he becomes like a not an AI, but just a program. You know, and you're, when you say that digital computers are hardened against noise, do you mean it's that ambiguity, that in-between space that they just can't grok?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, technically, our strictly digital computers, I mean, they each bit, by definition, has to be either black or white, zero or one. So even though there's a lot of noise in a digital computer, it's all been filtered out with marvelously just works of genius, the sort of error correction that goes on so that our machines mostly just run billions of cycles a second and never miss a single bit because they are, yes, they're hardened against any ambiguity. And that's both a wonderful thing for many applications, but it's not the way nature works. And of course, it makes systems very prone to failure, where you have a, you know, sort of software controlled 737 that suddenly does something that wasn't expected. Whereas, you know, the other example would be a bird that doesn't. I mean, you know, a bird might die, but it's not going to just suddenly fly into the ground.
Right. It could course correct. You know?
And it's two different ways. It's two very, very, very different approaches. But all I'm saying is why are we so fixated on this one approach? There's other approaches.
Well, because I guess the wealthiest people in the world right now have made a hell of a lot of money on this one approach and trying to mitigate the impact of the other one.
Yes, but there's a lot of money to be made with them. I mean, again, I think it's just amazing to me there aren't more sort of analog startups capitalizing on this. Behavior, you know, the remarkable behavior of these analog systems. I mean, we're doing it, but we're sort of stumbling into it. We're not deliberately.
Well, it's almost like we've relegated analog to the humanities. It's like the digital people will make GarageBand or whatever program you're going to record on, and then the airy, fairy, hippie, liberal analog people will play their instruments in a room, but be recorded by a digital person who has error-free software.
Yes.
To record, you know, the jazz musician whose errors are the precisely what we want to preserve. You know, I was thinking when you're talking about your dad, you know, the great Freeman Dyson. Most of us experience ourselves, because we're the next generation, as an improvement upon our parents. I mean, I feel like I'm smarter than my dad, you know, partly because he was poor and I had a better education and all that. But when your dad is a genius scientist guy, what is it like? Do you feel like he was like crazy smart, or is he just dad?
Oh, he was, I mean, he was just dad, but he was crazy smart. Everybody knew he was crazy smart. So no, I clearly knew it was downhill for me.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was, you know, and, you know, people always tell me, oh, George, you know, I really sympathize. It must have been so hard to be Freeman Dyson's son, you know, to live in that shadow. And that was easy compared to being Esther Dyson's little brother. Because yeah. Esther was like the best student the school had ever had. And so I was always a disappointment. I mean, I was 2 years in school behind her, and the teacher would see, I'm on the list, and they have all these expectations, which I would destroy very quickly. But in Analogia, there's a bunch of characters who drift through, and there's this group of characters who are very important. They were women, Helen Dukas and Trudy Szilard, who mm-hmm. both were partners of great scientists. Trudy was Leo Szilard's partner, and Helen Dukas was Einstein's sort of working assistant and archivist. And they both influenced my childhood tremendously, because they took me aside, and I don't know if they felt sorry for me or what, but they, you know, Helen Dukas gave me Kon-Tiki to read, and Trudy Szilard gave me The Voice of the Dolphins, and they both explained to me that I didn't have to be a scientist. They just made it clear my life would probably be more useful and better and happier. You know, you don't need to be a scientist. I mean, being a boat builder or something would just be fine. And that was a huge positive influence, and I thank them so much for that. Rather than, you know, all the other people would say, oh, you know, little George, you must be interested in physics.
Right. But you got to go be one of those. The amazing thing about Esther, your sister, is, you know, I had read her stuff and seen her talk. And, okay, so she's crazy smart, right? And then I finally meet her, and she's just like in jeans and barefoot, a t-shirt, and so human. And so, you know what I mean? She's so real at the same time. It's great because she could have just decided to be a scary person, you know, with that brain of hers. But she really didn't. It's amazing. Well, the three of you have each done your things.
She finally got a new apartment. I mean, after living 46 years in the same apartment, walk-up apartment in the East Village, she finally moved. So.
It's hard. It's hard to leave.
Three
once you
blocks,
find that,
I think she moved.
Oh, great.
So I can tell you my Michael Nesmith story.
Please.
I want to look at one of your podcasts. I listened, of course, to Michael Nesmith. So I was going to TED one year, and I got there early and didn't have a hotel room. So he said, you can stay with me in Carmel. And I'm a child like you. I mean, I grew up with the Monkees. We didn't have a television, but I certainly knew who they were. And my grandfather, Sir George Dyson, was a composer in England. And he, to me, I mean, as a child, those were the two most separate things that could ever be in the world, the Monkees and my grandfather, who wrote church music and composed some of the music for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth and wrote the march past for the Royal Air Force. But so I go to stay with Nez in Carmel, and in the morning, he says, come with me, I'm going to show you something. And he takes me up to this nearby church. And so the church in Carmel, the Church of Christ Scientist, a nice, big, beautiful church. And it turns out that they lost their organist. I think it was an accident or sudden death. So they suddenly had no organist. And somebody said, this guy Mike down the street, he plays the organ. So he plays the organ for that church. And he took me up there. We were alone. And he sat me down in the church. And then he in their hymn book, they had two hymns written by my grandfather. And he played them. So I never believed in my life. I would end up sitting in a church hearing Mike Nesmith of the Monkees play my grandfather's music on the church organ. So, just remarkable.
But that's it. I mean, that's actually the whole book, in a sense. You know, that the furthest you could get from that origin of music, it came right back, right through the hands of television's monkey.
Yeah, so there you go. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh, that's beautiful. Well, thanks so much, George. Thanks for what you do, for being on, for being a friend to all humans, but for coming on Team Human and sharing some of this. It's you're working on what I see as the problem of this era, you know, and everything else in one way or another, politically, emotionally, climately, anyway, is part of this fundamental problem we're having with the way we think about and execute technology.
Yes. Just keep repeating the same mistakes. So I'm definitely on Team Human with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been on Team Human. Our guest today, the author of Analogia, The Emergence of Technology Beyond Programmable Control, George Dyson. You can find out more about George and all of our guests at teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a paying subscriber and get all sorts of free stuff and access. And please, enjoy being alive. It doesn't last forever. Team Human is produced by Josh Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. Our community manager is Michael Bass. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.